Hi, I'm Ben Rizzuto, wealth strategist at Janus Henderson Investors. For 90 years, we've worked to help clients achieve superior financial outcomes and fulfill our purpose of investing in a brighter future together. To learn more, go to janushenderson.com.
This episode, we're bringing you highlights from the Future of Everything Festival. For 3 days, Wall Street Journal editors and industry minds gathered in New York to examine how advancements in science and technology are revolutionizing business, culture, and society. This was recorded in front of a live audience on May 8th at Spring Studios in Tribeca.
The Future of Everything, a look ahead from the Wall Street Journal with Jennifer Strong.
Comedian Francesca Ramsey tackles hard topics at the intersection of race and beauty on MTV and on Comedy Central. She's joined on stage by my colleague, Wall Street Journal editor Carla Zanoni, to break down changing norms in the beauty industry.
So Francesca, your message really beautifully ties together themes of culture, social activism, commerce in the beauty industry with comedy. Is this a message you feel a responsibility to deliver, or is it just good comedy?
I think there's something inherently hilarious about beauty. You know, the idea of, like, the things that we go through to look beautiful. Like, my husband is very handsome, but some days I'm like, I wish that I didn't have to think about brows and contour and lashes. Like, he just gets up, he's like, I'm ready, I'm going. And I'm like, I need like a solid hour, you know? Mm-hmm. There's something funny about the things that we put ourselves through and kind of analyzing how the way that we feel about ourselves is impacted by society and culture and how they kind of work together. I think that if you can talk about those things in a comedic way, they really resonate with people. Yeah. I didn't set out to be funny. I just was trying to be authentically myself in the way that I talk about certain topics and issues.
This is a tough question to ask, but I'm wondering, do you feel like that message would be delivered in the same way if you weren't beautiful?
I don't know. Well, thank you. That's very sweet of you to say. I mean, I think that's an interesting question, largely because beauty is so subjective. And we see that, especially with social media, we are having the opportunity to be exposed to all different types of people from so many different walks of life who might not be described as traditionally beautiful, mm-hmm. right? And so we are seeing beauty brands and fashion houses reaching out to women, men, mm-hmm. non-binary folk who don't fit into a box, but they're using their social platforms and reaching lots of people, and that's resonating with them. Mm-hmm. So beauty, I feel like, is very much in the eye of the beholder. And it also is a lot about confidence. Mm-hmm. You know, I've definitely seen a lot of people who have inspired me, and it's just because they really like and they feel good about who they are.
I mean, it's not lost on me. You really made your start doing tutorials about your locks on YouTube and reaching a new audience in that way. And I was thinking about your path over the past 10 plus years. I mean, what have you seen really transpire during that time?
I mean, I think what's really interesting is I went natural a little bit after high school. So I graduated in 2002, so I think I went natural in like 2004. Mm-hmm. And at that time, there was no ethnic beauty line or care line in Walgreens or Duane Reade. Mm-hmm. I never saw a natural-haired girl in an advertisement, whether it be with like a low fade or locks or braids. And so now I think it's really awesome that we're in a place where you can go into Walgreens and I can find a Shea Moisture. Mm-hmm. I can find kinky curly butters and creams and things that I used to have to trek to the hood to go get mm-hmm. because you couldn't get them anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And I think the same when you look at commercials and advertisements, you're seeing diversity in skin tones and body types, and I think that that's really awesome.
That's one of the things I wanted to ask you about. I mean, you take a look and you see big makeup companies, beauty companies, they have diversity messaging going out the wazoo, but sometimes there's criticism that the action doesn't match up with the words. What would it take for you to feel like, okay, we've actually made progress here, there's been change?
I mean, I think it's great to have diversity in front of the camera and on the pages, but I think that your leadership has to reflect a diverse world. And I think oftentimes we can tell when it's not authentic, or at least I can, because I'm like, wow, there's this beautiful black girl in this advertisement and her hair looks a mess. Like, who was the hairstylist? Like, who was on set that day? Because her edges are not laid and like her hair is dry, like she needs some moisture, right? And how many times have I been on set where I had to bring my own foundation or I had to bring my own hairstylist because no one knew how to do my hair? So it's like, it's really great if you have diversity represented on the page, mm-hmm. but who's actually making the brand decisions and saying like, how can we authentically speak to this audience? Right now, everybody is putting woke and shook in their ads and they're not using them the right way. They're like, we are so woke over this magazine. And I'm like, that does not make any sense. Like, not one black person worked on this ad, you know? Or like, that's how you have the Kylie Jenner situation or Kendall with Pepsi. So if you want to reach an audience, you need to not just do research on the audience, you need to have people from that community helping make decisions so that you can say like, well, this is how this audience speaks. Mm-hmm. This is what resonates with them. This is what's important to them. Mm-hmm. Having those communities make those decisions are gonna make your brand more authentic. And I think that's something that we're hearing everybody talking about is authenticity. It's not just the visual, it's the creative as well.
So how do you connect with your audience? I was thinking the YouTube audience is obviously, there may be overlap, but a little bit different from a Comedy Central audience or an MTV audience. What do you do to connect there?
I mean, I think the thing that social media has done is kind of removed those gatekeepers, where it used to be if you liked a celebrity and you liked their outfit or their makeup, you would just have to kind of fawn over it. And now we can say, like, where do you get your nails done? And I can respond and tell them, mm-hmm. right? Or I can tag the brand. So there's this level of engagement where people feel like they really get to know you. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, because I've been online for so long, people remember when I was in like that little bathroom in Miami with like my busted Target flower shower curtain that everyone keeps asking, like, where's that shower curtain? I'm like, we have moved on from that shower curtain. But they remember that about me, right? They remember when my husband proposed. They just get to know me in a way that you don't necessarily know or didn't know celebrities of the past. And so I don't think that that changes whether I'm on MTV or on Comedy Central or on YouTube. I'm still the same person when I'm not working, and I feel like that's what my audience really enjoys, and then it makes them want to support my work because they know how hard I worked to get here, and they know that I'm the same real person offline that I am online. Mm-hmm.
Do you take their suggestions to direct the kind of content that you create?
Yes and no. So my background is graphic design. I went to school for graphic design. And I always remember that our teachers would say, when you're pitching to a client, never show them the thing that you don't want them to pick, because that is the thing that they will pick. I kind of feel the same way when I like make decisions about my content. If I give people all of the options, they're going to pick something that I don't necessarily feel drawn to. But they often do make a lot of great suggestions. Mm-hmm. So I do get inspired by them, but I do think it's also important to open their eyes and point them in certain directions. How do I differentiate myself and add something new to the conversation that mm-hmm. everyone else isn't already mm-hmm. saying?
And so do you feel, as your audience has evolved, as it's broadened, do you feel a sense of responsibility to let people know, hey, you're using the word woke wrong, or hey, you haven't taken this on.
I think it's hilarious when people use it wrong. Like, I'm laughing.
So you kind of don't want to stop it.
I mean, yes and no. I think that everybody has to kind of decide what works for them, and mm-hmm. especially because I am someone that makes so much educational content. And I think this happens for marginalized communities in general. Oftentimes, we are called on to educate people all of the time. Mm-hmm. It's just like, explain to me your hair. Explain why I can't say this thing anymore, why people are upset about this. And there is a time and a place where I feel very comfortable and mm-hmm. confident doing that. And then there are my off hours where I'm just like, I just can't educate you all the time. And I think at some point, we have to do our own homework. We have to look past that first page of Google results. Mm-hmm. We have to look at sources that are not just Wikipedia, right? We have to say, okay, thank you for opening my eyes to this issue. Now I'm going to take that extra step and do the work to try mm-hmm. and find out myself. Mm-hmm. So I pick and choose. There are times when I think it's worth it, and there are other times mm-hmm. where I try to encourage people to do that work themselves.
I've been reading your book in preparation for this, and it's interesting to hear about your trajectory and how you've developed from creating content that you authentically connected with and that you needed, right? How to care for your hair, how to evolve in natural hair care. But it also starts to really touch upon social activism and this moment that we're living in right now, where I think people are really craving to have these kinds of connections, but there's a lot of conflict there.
Absolutely. I mean, I think inherently as people, we shy away from admitting what we don't know and when we've made a mistake. And I think that we see that in beauty industry, you know, like I was saying, I've had times where I've shown up and people didn't know how to do my makeup and they were like, no, it's fine. And I found myself saying like, no, you don't actually know, and it's okay to say that you don't know. It's okay to say that you're not prepared for this challenge and you need help. Mm-hmm. And I think that when it comes to more serious issues, especially around identity, mm-hmm. we are in a moment right now where people are afraid to say that they don't understand something, and especially online, because things can blow up so quickly. Mm-hmm. But on that same note, I do think that these conversations need to happen, and what I'm trying to encourage people to do is to have those conversations offline as often as possible, mm-hmm. because I do think, as amazing as the internet is and as great as it's been for my career, you lose the nuance of body language and eye contact mm-hmm. and, you know, when you sit down with somebody that you really care about and you have a conversation with them, it's going to be way more meaningful than dropping a GIF in their Facebook comments. We are using these things in a way where we think that the other person is understanding what we're saying, and actually talking to and connecting with people goes so much further. The internet, like, opens the door, and then I think we have to actually walk through the door.
Yeah. Exactly. I wanted to ask you, we're talking about beauty norms. It just seems like things are evolving so quickly. I'm wondering, what do you see as the future 5-10 years from now?
Oh, I have no idea. I mean, I never thought that I would be spending money to get eyelash extensions, right? Like, and they are my vice. Mm-hmm. I found a place that gives you a little foot rub while you get your eyelashes done. And I partly go there just for the foot rub. I never thought that those would be things that I would be doing, right? I have a lot of, like, gold in my hair now, which is something mm-hmm. that, again, was not something I was seeing previously. So I don't really know, but I do think, especially because there are so many innovative people using social media, and mm-hmm. I think it's, for me, I'm noticing a lot of people that are using beauty in creative ways, largely because they don't have access to the high-end beauty products that mm-hmm. you're getting at Macy's or at Bloomingdale's, right? Like, they're going to their local drugstore and they are figuring it out with mm-hmm. with the tools that they mm-hmm. have. So I would love to see that innovation continue. And I'm just trying to keep my mind open to the possibilities, because the things that I thought I would never do are things that now I feel like I can't live without. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I don't know, I'm interested to see where things go.
Yeah. One of the things that I think is really fascinating is I found this stat that African American consumers spend an estimated $2.5 billion per year. I'm wondering, what do you think woke people up? And by people, I mean
dollars.
Target, Walmart, CVS, et cetera.
Dollars, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's so funny. I remember, just as an actress, when Scandal became mm-hmm. like the big show, I got more calls that pilot season. I didn't book any, but I got more calls than I had ever gotten before, because Hollywood was like, yo, if we put a black woman on TV, like, they will watch this. This is wild. What is happening, right? Like, and it's so true. Like, I remember Icelandic Glacial, which is like a water company, they had this gorgeous dark-skinned black girl in their ad, and I was like, this is amazing. I had never heard of this brand before. They don't even have black people in Iceland. And then they had a black girl in this ad, and she was so, like, she was so dark, and she was so gorgeous, mm-hmm. and she was so vibrant, and she was somebody that I was not used to seeing in advertising before. And I think brands are realizing, again, the money portion of it, that, like, when you see somebody that looks like you, that it really goes a long way. Mm-hmm. And that's not just for women of color, that's for LGBTQ people, that's for plus-size bodies, that's people with disabilities, people that are disabled by beauty products. I saw I think it was like a Swiffer ad. The husband had a prosthetic. And I was like, this is huge, mm-hmm. right? Like, mm-hmm. this is showing a family where the guy is disabled, but they are raising their kids, and it's like not an issue for them, and it's just who he is. Yeah. And I was like, I am going to buy a Swiffer. I probably won't use it. I will put that towards my husband, but I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna like support this because this is really important. So I do think that the shift is that it's very interesting because especially as a woman of color, I have grown up watching shows and buying brands that did not reflect me, but I always found a way to relate. And so now that there is that extra step of that relatability, it really does go a long way. And I'm really glad that brands are waking up to it. Mm-hmm. But like I was saying before, I think the extra step is making those people in the roles behind the camera and in the marketing rooms and in the executive rooms so that they can really authentically reach audiences in ways that we haven't really seen before.
It's really interesting what you're saying about that ad and even a show like Scandal. It's not that African-American people haven't been on television. It's that they've been portrayed in a certain way. And you were telling me a story about going to do voiceover.
Oh, right. I do a fair amount of voiceover. And it's really funny to me because often you get called and they don't tell you what the commercial is. They just say, like, it's a 30-second spot for a fast food place. Right. And then you go, and it's like 30 black girls there. And I'm like, we all know what this commercial is. And then you go in, and this is what I sound like all the time. I'm from West Palm Beach, Florida, born and raised. And so often you go in the booth, and you read, and they're like, that was great. Can you just, like, give us a little... I'm just like, what, do you want me to shake my shoulders in the booth? Like, tell me what it is you want me to do. And they're just like, you know, flavor, urban. And I'm just like... But I'm an actual black girl, and this is what I sound like. And so I should be able to sell the product just as much as somebody who has, like, I'm not Cardi B, but, like, Cardi B has a space in media the same way that yes. I have a space in media, and the same way that, like, a Tiffany Haddish does, mm-hmm. or a Kerry Washington, or a Beyonce, like, well, Beyonce has her own space. But, like, we all fit in our own niches, and there's not one specific way to be a black woman. And so that is why a show like Scandal spoke to so many people, because mm-hmm. this was like a high-powered professional black woman who worked for the White House. It was just a different representation that we hadn't seen before, and that was very, very exciting.
Great. I just want to thank you, and I want to find out about the foot rub eyelash place. Not telling you guys about it. Thank you.
Next, we're going to take a peek at how emerging tech is changing how beauty and wellness products are created at the world's largest beauty company, L'Oreal. Please welcome my colleague Jennifer Strong with L'Oreal's Guive Belouche and the chief designer at Fuse Project, Yves Behar.
So we're in this moment where the possibilities for wearables feels pretty endless. But what are some of the challenges you face in designing them?
The challenges are, for me as a designer, are always about how technology has to become part of our everyday lives. If it adds complexity to your everyday lives, people will not adopt the product or they will not stay with it for a long time. So my challenge is to create a user experience and a product that just stays with you, that really accompanies us throughout our lives.
Which gets to something I was going to ask you a little bit later, but really, with all of these new technologies that you're working on, if people can't figure out how to use them, they're not worth anything. So how do you take something that's truly new and make it feel intuitive to use?
Essentially, my job today at L'Oreal is to figure out where beauty and technology intersect. And for that reason, I think what I've learned a lot from inspiration with working with people like Yves is this idea that we need to measure something that really can change behavior and that people really want to know about, and especially in beauty, where today it's a very holistic kind of experience. A lot of the challenges that we face today come around things like education, knowing about how much UV you're getting when you go outside and being able to use the appropriate level of sunscreen, or being able to have the right choice of products. And I think that these kinds of technologies like wearables have to seamlessly be integrated into someone's routine and help them to have a better relationship and a more enhanced relationship with the product that they're using in the beauty space.
I'll continue with on this thread for a second, which is we've designed a lot of firsts, whether it's the first Bluetooth speaker, the Jambox, or whether it's the Snoo, the smart bassinet that rocks babies to sleep. When you design firsts, the initial reaction, the initial instinct that people will have towards a product is it going to be too complex for me to adopt this technology or this product? So this is one of these technologies where there's a health crisis around skin cancer, and it's been going up in the last 10 years significantly. The question we ask ourselves is, how do we give real-time information to people about their sun exposure and motivate them to think about it and do something about it? If it can clearly, you know, adapt to your needs and then tell you which products or what kind of protection, you know, you need, then it becomes useful. And this is what UV Sense is.
Now, we have a wearable, actually, that you two collaborated on up here, if you want to tell us about it.
Essentially, we start with kind of two parts. The first is, how do we alleviate all of the challenges that today people face around wearables? And one of those is this idea that I have to always charge my wearable. I always have to, like, every night I have to put inside a charger. So we worked with Northwestern University, and we developed really a first of its kind. It's a technology which is flexible and allows you to put it anywhere on the body, but doesn't have a battery. The light will hit the sensor, and then you just bring the phone next to the actual wearable itself, and it sends the data through near field communication. So the advantage of that is when you take a battery out, you can make a technology really thin. So in terms of tech, it's really unique. And what we know is that today, with all of this kind of prevalence of melanoma, as well as kind of beauty in general, is very much affected by the level of UV that consumers are receiving. You have this kind of application that then gives you not only the UV exposure, but also all of the environmental kind of exposures you have outside with pollen and with pollution. And it's really like your skin coach.
So it works with your cell phone, it doesn't have a battery, but what about privacy? It feels like that's the thing we all want to talk about right now.
For L'Oreal, our approach has always been, I mean, as we really look at data as a kind of anonymized value, meaning that we collect anonymous data, but we don't link that to personal data. And there's a reason for that. If you think about, for example, UV today, one of the things that we've been able to do from this technology is we're able to publish a paper that shows the real-life exposure of UV across the world of people and their actual exposure, and we've brought that out to the entire scientific community to kind of get a better understanding of the level of exposure that people really have to UV. But our goal is not to push that to market. Our goal is to give the information for people to have that and to be able to get the right routines of products that they can use. And that's really where I think beauty and technology intersect in the best way, is when we can empower people with the information to use their kind of product and routines the right way and more in a personalized way. So we take that approach and we use it for R&D purposes, but we never really link that to personal data. So we take a pretty strict approach on that.
Now, Gabe, something I want to ask you about is bioprinting. And for those who don't know what this is, it's printing with live cells, and it's what's making things like 3D printed skin a reality. So I'm curious, what are some of the things you'll be using that for?
It's funny because at L'Oreal, we spent the past 25 years with this company called EpiSkin. It's in Lyon in this, France. And the role of this company is to kind of create tissue-engineered skin by hand. And it's been used for predictivity and modeling and things like that over the past 25 years. So we've really been at the forefront of that. And I think the first and foremost, it's great for the future ability to personalize the way we test products and to do that in a really kind of effective way when it comes to productivity. But obviously, you see in the world of technology today so much exciting work on being able to print electronics on the hand and being able to print biological materials on the body. And where I think it fits into kind of what we're talking about today is that wearables are moving to a point where they're integrated in the body, and the same with the ability to use things like bioprinting. You can think of endless applications of that, not even in, only in beauty, things like skin grafts and things that can really change the way that we look at the healing process in terms of skin. So I think there's a lot of potential in these kinds of smart materials and ways of printing, and I think there's a lot of potential in that.
Now, given you both do so many different types of projects, if you had to venture a guess, what's going to be the most transformative, disruptive technology in this space over the next decade, what would you guess?
So to me, the technologies themselves are, of course, interesting, but they're not the breakthroughs. Mm-hmm. The breakthroughs are the applications, how it's being used. So I've been working with sensors. We created the first tracker on the wrist, for example, for sleep and movement for almost 8 or 9 years. The technology now is in the hands of the designers, and it's how we cut it into shape. I think people can relate to this metaphor, but I see technology being just like fabric. You take a sensor, you take a battery, you take 3D printing, you put them together into completely new types of companies. Companies that will serve your personal needs because your skin color or your beauty needs are much more clearly identified. You use these to create completely new beauty concepts, new beauty brands. That's what we're working on. We're working on how to integrate a number of different technologies into completely new types of businesses and new ways to connect and engage with customers. Because today, the reality is beauty companies have zero relationship, you know, if we want to be really honest, zero relationship with their customers. And I think what's important is how technology creates a level of engagement and how it stays with you.
Keith, what about you? Any predictions?
What I think in terms of in the next decade, I really believe in this idea that technology will allow every person in the world to get the right product and really change the relationship between companies and consumers in a way where I as the user, I as the consumer, am telling the company what I want. And through technology, I'm allowed to kind of create that experience. And for example, you know, when you look, 50% of women can't find the right shade of foundation. This is absolutely not something we should be dealing with when we have technology today that can provide that kind of ability for people to get the precise product. So I think more and more, I believe in this idea that we're going to see the ability of the empowerment of people to be able to co-create products. And what my team has been really focused and laser focused on is kind of creating that beauty for everyone, beauty for all, but also beauty for you. So this ability to use technology in a way that people don't ever have to wonder if they can get the right product for them. So it's a general kind of point, but a lot of the projects that we are really investing in are more around that kind of precision of how to bring beauty to everyone and to make sure that they can have a voice in how they create their products.
Mm-hmm. Eve, specifically for you, how often are you inspired by historic representations of the future versus striking out on your own?
Well, I think historic representations of the future are actually an obstacle. You know, how Hollywood shows us the future is mostly 99% of the time a very dystopian way. Mm-hmm. And there are certainly things to learn from that, but I think in San Francisco, Silicon Valley, the Bay Area, we tend to be more utopian because we don't have movies to sell. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for me, the representations, what you see in films and whatnot, are actually an obstacle. When we design a robot that takes care of your babies, I said this for 6 years in working with Harvey Karp on the SNU, people immediately said, you know, I would never give my baby to a robot. I said that on purpose. I wanted to see people's reaction. And when they see and experience these new projects we work on, they're completely adaptable and adapted to your life, to your home, to your body, with wearables. So we actually have to fight the representations of the future. They're actually in the way of what is right for people because they're built for movie sales.
Agiv, in your labs, you work with a number of technologies. You've done a lot with AR. What's something that we don't know that you're working on?
Oh, God. Okay. Who's from L'Oreal here? Anyone? Everyone leave the room now. You know, I think we're really focused today on kind of the ability to transform things like AI and understanding how we can create more kind of holistic beauty experiences that are subscription-based and personalized and using technology, but really, again, going to that point about co-creation. An example of that is you have AR to be able to do things where you can see how virtually how makeup looks. But the question becomes then, how do I apply the makeup? A lot of times people are looking on YouTube and then pausing and then going and applying. And how can we make these kinds of relationships with our consumers more personalized and curated. So we're working a lot of these kind of technology platforms within my team around how we can create that. And a lot of times our partnerships with people like Eve and his team allow us to kind of work on the technology and beauty piece and have partners that are really great on other industries and in design to kind of create that. So we're invested in that. We're working a lot around personalization, and we're launching a lot of projects around how we can bring new types of formulas that through technology and personalized kind of miniaturized objects and supply chain that we can bring new products to people that you couldn't get before unless you had that kind of tech. So for example, our foundation project, which is called Le Temps Particulier, it's getting the perfect foundation for everyone's skin tone right there at the point of sale out of 8,000 options. You can imagine there are many more categories that we'd love to bring that to and to kind of be able to create that with our consumers.
And that is unfortunately all the time we have, but thank you both, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jennifer.
The Future of Everything is a production of The Wall Street Journal. This episode was produced by Anthony Green, Brian Gutierrez, Kristen Schwab, and Laura Sem. John Wurdock is the executive producer of WSJ Podcasts. Stan Parrish is the editor-in-chief of The Future of Everything. We had help with this episode from The Wall Street Journal's Nikki Waller, Kim Last, and Joanna Stern. With special thanks to festival organizers Karen Annis, Catherine Sterling, Andrea Acosta, Robin Wood Saylor, and Anna Rafdal. Thanks for listening. I'm Jennifer Strong in New York.
What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.